Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
But to not tell their viewers that they have a financial stake in the issue they're talking about, that's where we run into problems.
Our guest this time is Carl Frisch of Media Matters for America. He joins us to discuss what, if any, changes there have been in the corporate press since George W. Bush left office and Democrat Barack Obama stepped in after running on a change platform. The media watchdogs, historians, and headline analysts at Media Matters for America, mediamatters.org, continue to track such questions as they document what gets said, then fact-check it. You can find them online at mediamatters.org and their blogs Country Fair and the new Limbaugh Wire about conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh. Carl Frisch, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We're still unwinding from the U.S. presidential campaign, aren't we?
I think the unwinding finishes just about the time we start winding back up.
Do you think editors and publishers, producers are sort of still weeping in their beer that the campaign is over?
No, they've already moved on.
Have they?
They've already moved on to 2012, which is the sad thing. You know, they cannot live in the moment to save their lives. So anytime you see somebody like Sarah Palin or Mitt Romney or Michael Huckabee making any kind of movement, immediately it's banner news.
And so we're talking about the lineup that was recently on display at the conservative convention, right?
CPAC? Yeah, the CPAC, the annual conference of conservatives, mostly young, here in Washington. And people probably have never heard of it, CPAC, but they may remember, I think it was the year before last, Ann Coulter, the right-wing author, was there, and that's when she called Senator John Edwards an epithet describing him as a gay man.
I want to take a real look at this because I know you have a lot of coverage of the CPAC convention online at Media Matters, and we also spoke with Media Matters senior contributor Eric Bollert. But let's first listen to just a little bit of the coverage of the CPAC convention from NPR's Maura Liasson. And it sounded almost like a typical political convention.
Republicans are out of power, and the new Democratic president has sky-high approval ratings. But none of that dampened the spirits of David Keene, the president of the American Conservative Union, which sponsors the CPAC event. Indeed, Keene says conservatives are feeling liberated because George W. Bush, who many on the right felt undermined their cause, is out of office.
One of the reasons for the enthusiasm here is that now they think they've got a chance to get that party that they work for, to get its act back together. It's not being out of power that's liberating. It's not having someone in power who's telling you, go along with me because this is the way it has to be.
The CPAC conference is a required stop for any Republican presidential hopeful, even if the election is 1,348 days away.
So this was how Media Matters' Eric Bollert saw things at the CPAC convention.
There was quite an array of interesting speakers yesterday. One of them suggested nuking Chicago, which got a huge applause line. One of them suggested we don't know where Barack Obama was born, and that got lots of cheers and yelling. You know, it's the right wing of America, and it's interesting, but it goes back to, you know, the hate of Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter. I mean, the conference itself is sort of a celebration of a sort of right-wing hate. But I doubt that was the main angle of Maura Liasson's report, and it's not the angle of anyone within the Beltway Press who goes over there and talks about CPAC. I mean, if liberals had held a conference 35 days into George Bush's presidency in you know, February of 2001, and were selling bumper stickers and buttons suggesting, you know, Bush was a, well, with Obama, you know, he's a communist, he's a socialist, he's a fascist, and things like that. I mean, that would have just been absolutely astounding and hugely controversial, and the press would have asked, you know, how does that affect Democrats, and how are they going to separate themselves from this lunatic left that was becoming unhinged 1 month into the Bush presidency. But that's precisely what's happening with the right wing, and the press doesn't see it as newsworthy or anything like that. And the hate that, you know, Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and the bloggers and the right-wing pundits have unleashed on Obama in just 30 days, with all this talk about communism, socialism, fascism, it's really unprecedented, but the press doesn't really give it much attention. attention or doesn't treat it as unusual or newsworthy.
Media Matters' Eric Bollert. Here now, Media Matters audio coverage of the CPAC convention and remarks by former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., John Bolton, talking about President Barack Obama.
He said during the campaign he thought Iran was a tiny threat. Tiny, depending on how many nuclear weapons they're ultimately able to deliver on target. It's tiny compared to the Soviet Union, but is the loss of one American city, pick one at random, Chicago, is that a tiny threat? You know, this... A threat to the safety of any American is a threat to our nation.
Media Matters has a signature ending, and we just heard it. Carl Frisch, it seems almost as if the conservatives were dissing George W. Bush as if they never supported him.
Right. It's kind of like when you're in elementary school and you've had this friend for a really long time, and then you get to junior high and it's a new school and you want to be popular and you realize that your good friend, little Timmy, isn't, or I guess George in this case, isn't popular, and he's kind of a lightning rod around school. So you go join the popular kids and you start making fun of little Georgie. That's essentially what the conservatives have done. They voted with him. They voted for him. They advanced his policies unquestioningly. And now, oh, he wasn't a conservative after all, you know, because if they were to say he's just as conservative as we are, which he is, it would undermine all that they claim to stand for because it didn't work.
Well, it almost sounds as if they're wondering who they are. They're going through an identity crisis, only the media is kind of ignoring it.
It's like a bad reality show is what it's like.
How bad?
You know, it's like watching Extreme Party Makeover.
What kind of things do you think should be raised as far as the party itself? I mean, there was this factor of having lost the election, but beyond that, what should the media be noticing?
You know, back in the day when progressives were out of power for years, what you saw often in the media was this notion that progressives were coming apart at the seams, that they were unorganized, they couldn't get their act together, and there was a lot of bickering and infighting. And we're seeing a lot of that with conservatives now. You've got governors saying that congressional Republican leadership is inconsequential. You've got governors attacking Limbaugh, Congress people attacking Limbaugh and then coming back around. He's really like the major voice of the conservative movement these days. So there's a lot of bickering and infighting among conservatives in this cocoon, with media intellectual conservatives talking about the need for change in the party and activist-based people saying that they just weren't conservative enough. So what I'd like to see is the media putting the same reporting and time into looking at that story that they had for progressives for years. You know, there are just so many examples of this infighting between conservatives. It's kind of become a self-mockery.
Who really are the biggest funders of America's corporate press right now? And in that same vein, if you're talking about media as an elite, a group representing an elite in America, mm-hmm. is this the Ivy League elite or is this the ultra nouveau riche elite? Who are these people and who supports them in economic terms?
In terms of the corporate media, much of it is companies that everybody's heard about. You know, GE owns NBC and a vast array of different media conglomerates. Disney is ABC. News Corp is Rupert Murdoch's company that owns Fox News, 20th Century Fox, and a variety of different papers, including the Wall Street Journal and the New York Post. And there are a few others as well. So it's similar to how it's been going back to the Hearst days. Individuals control great power in the media. What we're seeing, though, is that this power has been kind of meshed together into the hands of very few people. And I'm not one to be prone to conspiracy theories that we can't trust reporting because of the corporate influence, but it's certainly there. In the same way, I don't buy into the notion that there's a liberal media bias, because it's not something that you can prove. What I'm more concerned about is whether or not reporting is accurate. And that's something that someone with a critical eye and the ability to use Google can figure out for themselves. And that's something that we do every day at Media Matters on our website, mediamatters.org, is we take a magnifying glass to reports from cable news, network news, daily newspapers, the weekly news magazines, talk radio, those all-important Sunday shows. We watch them, and we hold them accountable for accuracy, and then we post the transcripts and the background information and the supporting documents and the video and the audio on our website.
And, for example, if our Secretary of Defense had a comment that, let's say, a certain aircraft was way too pricey and that it hadn't been used in the last war, so why are we still building it? We wouldn't necessarily expect that NBC would jump to cover this story and report all the details, because we'd be talking about
their bottom line.
Well,
you do see it sometimes. This is why I think it's so important for people. You know, we often talk about the media as the fourth estate that hold the powerful accountable. Well, if all we do is trust that the media is going to do that, nobody's going to hold the media accountable. When people do rise up and take action and contact the media and make a big stink about things, the media will cover things. As an example, for weeks on end, Andrea Mitchell was hosting Senators Trent Lott and John Breaux, who are now both lobbyists that lobby on behalf of the energy industry and the oil and gas industry. And she was bringing them on to discuss energy policy, which GE has a big financial tentacle into. And Media Matters, along with several environmental groups and a lot of other people concerned with journalistic ethics, started a campaign where we contacted and raised a stink over the fact that she was not identifying the connections of these two guys. And since that campaign, every time they go on, they are identified as energy lobbyists. And I think that gives better context. It's not that they can't talk about these things, because, of course, they're going to have an opinion. They're former senators, for crying out loud. But to not tell their viewers that they have a financial stake in the issue they're talking about, that's where we run into problems. And, you know, that's why I think it's important that people, whatever the most important issue they have in their life, whether it be reproductive rights or civil rights or the economy or the environment, the number two issue has to be the way the media covers that issue. Otherwise, whatever progress they hope to achieve on their issue of importance will never be realized.
You didn't mention human rights, and I want to point that out only because we've had so many.
Human rights. There is an endless litany of issues that people latch onto as their most important, you know, their most important issue personally. You know, for me, it has a lot to do with the war, has a lot to do with human and civil rights. So I pay particular attention to those issues in the media, because that's what's going to affect the progress I want to see happen.
What would you say stands out to you in the media coverage thus far of Obama's first few months in office?
You know, Eric Bullard, who you had on earlier, had a good column after, I think it was about 2 weeks, remarking that the White House press corps had suddenly decided to start doing their jobs with President Obama, jobs that they had neglected for 8 years under George Bush. So I think that they have been tougher on President Obama in his first 30 days than they were certainly of George Bush in his first 30 days to his first 4, 5, 6 years. But, you know, the biggest problem I've had thus far is that we see outright lies and distortions passed off as fact in news report after news report. And I'll give you two examples. Two started as conservative talking points that are fundamentally just not true. We've seen report after report from the New York Times to Fox News to CNN to Washington, D.C. Hill newspapers claiming that the president's economic recovery plan, it contains $30 million for a mouse, a endangered species that's a mouse, in Nancy Pelosi's district in San Francisco. The mouse exists. The $30 billion to save the mouse does not exist. There is no such funding in the legislation at all. Yet, and here's how it started, a Republican leadership aide sent an email to reporters who, rather than check the information to see if it's true by actually looking at the legislation, reported it as fact without attributing it to an anonymous Republican aide. Greg Sargent, a blogger at the Washington Post who used to blog for TPM, Talking Points Memo, looked into it and disproved it. Another newspaper went on to do the same thing, but the myth persisted. And even, I think it was two nights ago, Sean Hannity brought it up when he was interviewing Congressman Joe Sestak from Pennsylvania, a Democrat. And Sestak basically said, Sean, quit reading these rumors on the internet. It's not in there. And Hannity's essential response was, yes, it is, and you know it. And he said, it's not in the legislation. I've read it. And Hannity said, that's because you've hidden it, as if there's some invisible ink on the legislation that only Sean Hannity can read. The same thing is true for this high-speed train myth that there was going to be a train from Disneyland to Las Vegas to help Harry Reid. It's just not true. There's, I think, $9 billion for light-speed rails throughout the country, and not one of the routes is Las Vegas to Disneyland. It's just baloney. So seeing those kinds of patently false, demonstrably false claims made by conservative or Republican staffers make their way into news reports without anybody taking a minute to even think, is this accurate, has been disheartening, and it's been extremely bad under this president.
Carl Frisch, what about the introduction to the U.S. voters of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State? Clinton, her first trip was to Asia, public broadcasting network, PBS, and I believe it was the Lehrer NewsHour, mentioned this question, is she going there to basically drum up money to pay for Obama's stimulus package? I didn't hear that discussion, that level of discussion about that question that I heard about, let's say, the mouse question. But is that the kind of question that maybe should be asked? I mean, is the
sure,
Obama?
I think the difference is that, you know, you've rarely ever heard President Bush talk about, you know, selling the American soul to the Chinese for loans. You do hear Obama talk about what's at stake here and what we have to do to get there. He hasn't denied that when we borrow money, we have to get it from the Chinese and other sources. So are they hiding something? I don't think so. I think it's probably good that the media is covering that, because I think it would help a lot more people understand just how bad things are. One of the things that the president talked about in his address to Congress on Tuesday that I thought was good, his first address to a joint session of Congress, was that he's going to do an honest budget procedure where everything's brought into the budget so that we don't put things on the side and kind of pretend like we're not spending the money, like the Iraq War, for instance, which George Bush refused to include in his normal budgeting process, which kept Congress having to come back time after time with emergency funding bills. So he's going to bring everything into the budget. It's likely going to make the deficit look much larger than it has ever looked before, because it will finally be honest. You know, I think you won't see action from the American people about what we owe the Chinese, what we owe other folks who have loaned money to the U.S. Until there's a complete accounting of those dollars. And it's encouraging to see the president moving in a direction that's an actual more open and honest and transparent budgeting process, because then we'll finally know.
Well, doesn't the Obama team also have a lot to say about creating more American industry and buying American? This seems to me to be the question of interest.
They do, and there have been some good things that I've heard thus far about the proposed budget and omnibus spending bill, that there will be a cap and trade, which, for people that don't know, basically makes it so that certain prerequisites have to be met environmentally and labor-wise for trade policy. In addition, there were Buy American clauses in the president's economic recovery bill, which are good. They're going to get more people back to work. And I think one of the cornerstones, the two cornerstones of his efforts to help rebuild the economy after he tackles the housing crisis, are very important to the long-term economic recovery of America. The first being health care reform, which is a tremendous burden on business in this country. And the second being the green economy. Ample investment in the green economy so that we can lead on that. You know, the country that gets there first is going to have a tremendous boom, just like we did with the internet, but probably much longer lasting, because it's not really that, it's not something that's like a bubble. It's something that's going to be, you know, that will continue. And it's encouraging that President Obama wants to get there instead of, you know, the bunk talk from President Bush about how we're addicted to oil and, you know, we can't get it from foreign leaders and governments, but we continue to do it anyways, because it was just lip service.
On the other hand, Barack Obama did mention in his speech to the nation that, you know, we are going to be working to develop clean coal.
Right.
This has become a buzzword for people who understand there's essentially no such thing. But let me broaden that a minute, too, because...
Well, that's the kicker. There is no such thing currently. And my understanding is that because of the policies that they've sort of announced, that the building of new coal plants has basically ceased because of the president's policies. You know, the one thing I think we can trust for sure is that Joe Biden and Barack Obama are not going to allow these plants to operate or to claim that they're clean coal without the technology being there. If they could figure out a way to capture carbon emissions from coal plants, would it be a good thing? It'd be an excellent thing. And we'd make a ton of money as a country because, you know, I believe China's one of the largest coal-producing countries in the world, and they have horrible emission issues. And if we could actually create the technology, I think it'd be good. I think that he has got his priorities placed on much more important things, though, than chasing this technology that has yet to exist down a rabbit hole.
Well, Carl Frisch, in Connecticut, we have some of the highest electric bills in the country, and I was looking at mine the other day and noticing that they've attached all these costs. You know, they're passing on the costs to the consumer of their future development and changes they're going to have to make within the industry. Among those changes, of course, they want to put ever higher wires and these mega electric transfer systems through states like mine. So there's a lot of opposition to that. There's safety questions. But also, I think the question needs to be raised, at what point do these electric utility companies nationwide start to consider themselves part of this country and start to work, you know, in a sort of a team spirit to help reduce electric, use of electricity? And maybe they could even get on board with some of the, you know, new developments of technology, wind, solar.
You'd think that with all those lovely commercials they run that look like they're from National Geographic.
Well, it's fascinating why this hasn't happened.
Well, and my hope is that when the president talks about proper regulatory control of various industries, that he does look strongly at the energy industry, because there is a great need to rein in what has been dismantled over the last 10 years, not just in Wall Street and banking and what we hear about in the news every day, but in a variety of industries, particularly those that affect the environment. And I think that, a lot of people are going to be affected in the coming years by energy prices, by new technologies. And it'll be just like with the pharmaceutical lobby and with the healthcare industry, rather than risk seeing their profits, you know, their multi-million and billion-dollar profits go down in the slightest, their profits, not their bottom line, they're going to try and pass it off on consumers. Hopefully that's something that they can tackle.
No, I understand you're working on a topic that a lot of people have heard mention of, but a lot don't understand, the U.S. Census, right?
Yeah. We get so consumed with, you know, the horse race for president. It's like, who's it going to be? You know, Holy Huckabee, Moneyed Mitt. And the real fight for 2012 is happening right in front of the media's nose, and they're not doing much to cover it. And it's the census in 2010, because the census in 2010 is going to dictate how congressional districts are drawn in 2012 and ultimately could affect power in Congress for years to come. We kind of saw a bit about it when Senator Judd Gregg stepped down from his nomination to be Commerce Secretary, and conservatives started blaming the fact that the president wanted to be more involved with the census as the reason, even though, mind you, Senator Gregg said it wasn't the main reason why he was stepping down. And beside the fact that the president is always involved in the census and that the Commerce Secretary and the Census Bureau ultimately report to the president they serve, they kept on pushing this. So it brought up a couple other issues that I raised in the column about statistical sampling and these kind of baseless remarks and talking points from conservatives that get circulated in the media every 10 years. And I try and debunk those in a way that's funny and educational.
But are you suggesting, let me just make this clear, that the Republicans, conservative candidates, are going to try to redistrict their way back into office?
Well, they certainly did it in the last census. Tom DeLay and his cohorts, people remember Tom DeLay, the former majority leader, Republican, indicted from Texas, led an effort throughout the country and primarily in Texas to get control of state legislatures so that whatever happened with the census under Bill Clinton, they would be able to redistrict their states to add more congressional seats for the Republican Party. And various aspects of his efforts in Texas have been analyzed in documentaries and books and thrown out by courts. You know, the biggest argument out there about the census right now is that statistical sampling is only being used because Democrats want more power. The flip side to that argument, because they're basically what they're saying is that Democrats just want to count more black people, more brown people. The flip side to that argument is that conservatives don't want to count black and brown people. And they often claim, when pushed against the wall, that the Supreme Court has called this unconstitutional, statistical sampling, which is just an outright lie. The Supreme Court did hear a case about statistical sampling, but they specifically said that their decision had nothing to do about the constitutionality of sampling, only that Congress didn't have the authority to do it because they had a rule banning it. But if Congress wanted to change the rule, they could absolutely do statistical sampling, which numerous scientific societies have said is much more accurate than a door-to-door or mail-in headcount.
Well, you know, it occurs to me that CNN better take notice of this story because John King's going to have to change all of those maps that he's
yes,
been.
Yes, he is.
You know what I mean?
Well, and you know, Lou Dobbs, of course, as soon as people start talking about the census, will be talking about how Democrats just want to count illegal immigrants, which, you know, it doesn't take much to get Lou Dobbs worked up and try and fit away into a story to talk about undocumented immigrants. It's quite sad.
This could be our future unless you, the listener, take a stand. Carl Frisch, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Carl Frisch has worked on numerous political campaigns over the past decade. He served as multimedia communications director and member of the renowned web team for Howard Dean's 2004 presidential campaign. And we'll be hearing more from Carl Frisch and Media Matters' Eric Bollert, author of the book Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, on Friday, March 6th at 6 p.m. Finally, there's a special program airing on Pacifica Station KPFK tonight at 8 p.m. Pacific Time. They'll be working with Hollywood celebrities in support of prominent peace groups like Code Pink, bringing attention to Gazan women and children with a video peace bridge between L.A., Cairo, and Gaza. And we spoke with Jordan Elgrabi, executive director of the Levantine Cultural Center, where the celebrities will gather to join in with this link-up.
Alice Walker and others, Medea Benjamin, they're in Cairo right now. And Wednesday, the 4th of March, there's a fundraising event here at the Levantine Center in L.A. where Eric Roberts and Raya Medine and other celebrities who work in Hollywood are going to be here to talk about figuring out ways to tone down the violence and get more more negotiating back on the table. We've got, you know, all these various Hollywood folks mixing in with the Code Pink activists and Levantine Center activists, and we're going to have a live radio broadcast with KPFK where Don Bustani, who runs the show called Middle East in Focus for 12, 13 years now, is going to be talking to Eric Roberts, and to Raya Medine and these other folks and doing interviews with them, and then he's going to talk to the activist in Cairo live, and we'll hear all that here. So we'll be connecting Cairo with L.A., and they're hoping to pick somebody up in Gaza as well. And then at 9 o'clock, we actually have a live concert with a Palestinian musician and a Jewish Israeli musician.
Other Hollywood performers involved in this effort are Roseanne Barr, Marissa Tomei, Michelle Schacht, Annie Lennox, Ben Affleck, Eric Roberts, all have recently been expressing dismay at the Gaza war and the humanitarian crisis there. You can find information about KPFK's Don Bustany and the show Middle East Focus online, and we'll put information about the show on our website, talknationradio.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.